So welcome again, and thank you for inviting me for this first talk. So I was thinking about the talk over the last number of weeks and thinking, well, it sounds like an easy topic, introduction to Buddhism, really. You know, I could just raid Wikipedia for that, can't I? Do a bit of cutting and pasting in honour of the man who invented cutting and pasting, who just died. But each of you, being university students, very skilled university students, can read Wikipedia for yourself, or any sort of, you can Google and, or use whatever search engine is the search engine of choice, and find all that information for yourself. So I didn't just want to regurgitate, history, cosmology and so forth of Buddhism. Many of you here will already have some fundamentals under your belt, and maybe even more than that too. So what I wanted to think about really was the challenge involved in talking about Buddhism itself. And hopefully this will constitute partly an introduction to Buddhism for those who maybe are still learning a little bit as well. So, you know, just to cite my own experience, just as I've said, the urge is to go and look everything up and have it at your fingertips. And I think that's a great idea. But it's very interesting to check the motivation in doing that. So often we do that sort of thing so we're ready. We're ready to put out there what Buddhism is, and also to very carefully explain what it isn't. It's like we load up our ammunition, our Buddhist ammunition, and we're ready for the next encounter. Like, so what's this Buddhism stuff then? Aha, bang, we've got it ready to go. So I really wanted to avoid that sort of, this is Buddhism, you know, and take it out to the streets and, you know, preach the Dharma. I remember when I went on my first meditation retreat. And some of you have heard me speak before, I've heard this story, but it was a long time ago. And it was a 30-day retreat. It was very difficult. It was hot. It was actually at Wat Buddha Dharma at Wiseman's Ferry. It was a drought year, and the hall was really hot. It was hotter inside than outside. It was, you know, difficult, challenging. That was my first retreat. Anyway, so I came home. I went back down to Melbourne where I lived, got the overnight bus and went home. So I was a bit spaced out. I was a bit space cadetish, really. And my parents plucked up courage and said to me, so what's this Buddhism about, Mike? I said, because I was spaced out, I said, oh, it's about the fact that everything changes. So what I would like to find tonight is something of the middle path between the extremes of loading our Buddhist ammunition and shooting people with facts, but being a little bit vague about, oh, it's all about change. Somewhere between those two, and each of you will find your comfort zone between those two examples. So we come to what Buddhism is, and really, if we got a, well, we've got a gathering of a whole lot of different people in this room, but particularly if we've got people from different cultures as well, many different cultures in this room, we would probably find there's a lot of different ideas once we started discussing as to what Buddhism is. And maybe I'll ask you later what you think it is sometime through the talk. So there's many different ways of thinking about Buddhism. Very broadly, we could say it's a religion. We could say it's a philosophy. We could say it's a cultural phenomenon specific to each country that it's in, and a little bit different in each country. And if we say that, we could look at each country and go, my gosh, there's lots of different variations in the way people act as Buddhists. They do all these different things. Even their Buddhas look different. The Buddhas look like them in that country. Have you ever noticed that? Tibetan Buddhists look Buddhas look Tibetan, Chinese Buddhas look Chinese, Thai Buddhists look Thai. There's a development in Western Buddhism as well, you know, sort of slightly bigger nose Buddhists, if I can say that, by some of the Western groups. So this is another aspect of how Buddhism is very different across cultures and so forth. So if we ask a mythical, you know, Westerner, our typical Westerner, what Buddhism is, they might say, oh, it's about meditation. And I think that would be a fair bet that most people, most Westerners, if I can use that slightly outdated term, is about meditation. Very reasonable. That's the way it's come into the West, hasn't it, as a meditation practice. And the word that was mentioned before was vipassana, or insight meditation, the one that I've practiced in Burma predominantly. And so some people who are a bit more into the Dharma, into the Buddhist teachings, might say, oh, it's about vipassana meditation. Others might say it's about another sort of meditation. And if you ask them further, they might say, well, no, it's not a religion. And I think actually many Westerners and Buddhists would say it's not a religion. And they might say, no, it's really more like a philosophy, or they might say it's a way of life. That's a very common thing for people to say. And I'm not saying any of these things are wrong, but nor am I saying they're right either. They're ways of thinking about this thing we're calling Buddhism when we begin to think about it ourselves. And I think it's quite useful for us to explore as we go along for ourselves. What is it that I think Buddhism is? If somebody was to stop me in the street with three or four questions about Buddhism, I wonder what I'd say. So interesting to think about that. Some Westerners really like Buddhism or meditation because they think it's in harmony with science. So, there's a lot of research happening about what happens in the brain when we're meditating. There's vast amounts of research. There's tens of thousands now of research papers in that specific area alone. Some Buddhists would say it's medical. So it's about addressing pain in the body, for example. Or it's about addressing therapeutic issues like anxiety or depression. That also is a very strong strand, and I'm sure you're all aware of that as well. The classic phrase we used to hear, and I don't know if we hear it anymore, whether you've heard it, is I'm spiritual but not religious. Is that still a thing? Do people still say that? Maybe that's a Western thing. So people want to say, well, it's not a religion, but I feel like it's something bigger than me. It feels like a religion, but it's not religion. And here what they mean by that is there's nobody telling them what to do. They don't necessarily have to go to church. They don't necessarily have to do what everybody else is doing and so forth. Spiritual but not religious. And they might even go so far as to say, and there's no need for monks or nuns. Really? What's the point? It's each person's own experience. Surely that's what Buddhism's about. Meditation is about our own experience. A hipassigo, come and see for yourself. So these might be quite legitimate things to say for some people, and they have been said. So that's our sort of the mythical Westerner that I've pulled out of the air and talked about. What about if we ask somebody more from what we used to call the East, which again is a very outdated term, I know, but from Burma, Thailand, China, Mongolia, Tibet, and so forth, Sri Lanka. Apologies to the other countries I didn't name then, Cambodia. So they might say, if you ask them, or indeed if you ask their parents, maybe I've asked your parents, what's Buddhism? They might say, well, it's about going to the temple. It's about dana, making offerings, practicing generosity. But particularly it's about generosity towards the monks and the nuns. That counts for more. And with some traditional Buddhists, and I make no judgment about this, they say the greater the attainment of the monk or the nun, the more merit accrues to me. So if I can pick up the person with the special powers and make some offerings to them, I will get more merit made. It's actually going to work better for me. So it's a transactional thing. And much of what I said about the Western Buddhists, it's transactional as well. We want something for ourselves. So they might say it's about dana, sila, that is practicing right speech, right thought, right action and so forth, living a good life, at least at the time they go to the temple. And they might mention things like, offering food to the monks if they're going on alms round, or the nuns rarely, but if they were to go on alms round as well, offering food. There might be some family shrines at home that might be built in with acknowledging the ancestors, people who have died. That's very much built into many Buddhist cultures. It's just, and it's seen to be part of Buddhism, and I'm not saying it's not, it's just a cultural practice as well. And finally, one of the really dividing points, I think, is, and it comes back to making merit. Making merit is accruing spiritual points, I suppose we could say them in a way. But what is that for? And for many traditional Buddhists, people who are born as Buddhists in their own countries, that's about a better rebirth in the next life and the next life and the next life, such that one might, if one's got a very high aspiration, hope to meet up with the Buddha when the next Buddha comes back. You'll be around to actually hear from the Buddha. There was a view for a long time in many countries, hundreds of years, perhaps longer, that enlightenment couldn't happen anymore. Awakening, nirvana couldn't happen, and you just had to wait till the next Buddha rocked up. And then if you managed to make merit and so forth, and you were there, fantastic. So, and I don't want to disparage that, because that's been the glue of many societies, those beliefs, the glue of very moral and decent behaviour. Very useful practices. However, if we go back to our mythical Westerner, they might say, well, there's no need to believe in rebirth. Really, how does that help? It's all about here and now at Upasiko. And so we see already, even at this level, when we're just considering what it might be, we get lots and lots of different notions. And these are just a few I picked out to speak to very briefly tonight. Lots of different notions about what it might be. So really, an introduction to Buddhism is really more like an introduction to exploring what you think Buddhism is, what your Buddhism is. And it might be interesting another time for you guys to have a conversation about this, have a, you know, like a led discussion. So what do we think it is? Are we all in furious agreement, or are we just furious with each other? And can we tolerate other people's beliefs about it too? Traditionally, Buddhists have been somewhat tolerant of other beliefs. Although we also know there are some shocking practices today where people seem to have lost that tolerance for other beliefs. So Buddhism is not immune from that. So we can see that if we adopt any of these particular views, they can change our perspective of what Buddhism is and what it's leading to, what we get here and now, what it means to be a Buddhist amongst other people and so forth, how we live. So to go back to rebirth for a moment, if we just pick out one strand like rebirth, if you believe in rebirth, it may well be that your view about the urgency of liberation here and now, hey, Upasiko, might mellow a bit. It's like, no, I've got time. I go to the temple, I do the right things, I guarantee a more fortunate rebirth. Don't know what it would be, but I do all the right things. And so you could be a bit more chilled about practicing meditation, for example. And we know that over the last couple of thousand years, and a bit longer, that meditation for lay people has been almost non-existent as far as we know. And we certainly know that for many ordained people, meditation has been practically non-existent as well. So if we believe in meditation, we're doing something quite novel. Well, that will alter what we think Buddhism is as well. And we might get people from traditional societies, and I've actually heard this said, why are you meditating? That's for the ordained sangha. You just play your role in supporting that, make merit, and so we go back to this idea of rebirth. We can chill out a bit as long as we're doing the right things. I've been on, as I said, quite a lot of meditation retreats, and a few in Burma and Thailand, Nepal, and in each of those places you get very intense Westerners, and nearly always very intense Western men. You come along and it's really crash through or crash. You know, I'm going to get this liberation thing or not. And they're, you know, ultra, you know, strict, precise for a little while, and very often they don't last very long because they're too tight about it. They could probably do with a touch of believing in rebirth just to chill out a bit and loosen up and give themselves some time. So swings and roundabouts, even just with that one view about rebirth, it can alter the whole way we approach this Dharma, the practice of Dharma, whatever practice means for you. I'm going to talk about enlightenment a bit later. That's one of the most challenging topics, obviously, so I'll hold that out there and then you can challenge me on that. So given all of that, all those differences around the whole Buddhist world, the Buddhist diaspora, is there anything we can say that's in common, that we can say is a thing we can talk about if we're talking about introduction to Buddhism as a sort of total thing? And I think there are some things that we can point to. So let's go back to the early suttas and let's have a think about just the early life of the Buddha. And I don't want to labour this for too long, and so I'll just touch on it lightly. What I should have said right at the start is, if you want to stop me and ask questions or indeed add something as well, that would be very useful. I'm happy to keep talking. I can talk. But, you know, it's a much better thing if you get your questions or thoughts addressed. And if you don't want to do it during the talk, I've left plenty of time after for us to have a conversation should you want to do that as well. So, you know, this is for you to listen to, but then it's also for you to digest for yourself as well. This is not the authoritative word. It's my view. I'm just one of those Western Buddhists. So, you know, feel free to put your hand up and go, I don't think so. Okay, so in regards to the life of the Buddha, very briefly, we know Shakyamuni, Buddha, named such because he was of the Shakya or Sakya clan, fairly highly born about 2,500 years ago, northeastern part of India or southwestern part of Nepal. And there's you can go to Lumbini now and there's lots of shrines being built by various Buddhist organizations at what is supposed to be the birthplace of the Buddha. So interesting to visit there as well. Quite a few meditation places there as well. We have a lot of mythology around the birth of the Buddha and the life of the Buddha, we don't have a lot of historical detail that's completely verifiable. We know, for example, in the early suttas, that, and in, certainly in the Mahayana suttas and so forth that came later, a lot of the Buddha's life has just been written about as time has gone on. It's been added to. There's this mythology built up around, and a cosmology built up around the Buddha, you know, his noble birth, being a king. Well, he wasn't a king. He lived in a more like what we would call a republic, I think, today. There were, you know, various clans and people who were had more money and so forth, more status and prestige. But we can say that he was born into one of those clans and was fairly highly born as well, I suppose, which would have meant there was education and some leisure time, some good food, time to reflect and so forth. So when we think about the mythology, and just to pick out one example, we can think about the special marks, so-called special marks of the Buddha. Remind me, 37 special marks for those Buddhist specialists? Am I right in saying that? The lakana, the marks of the Buddha. Well, you know the thing on top of his head that you see, the Ushnisha, that's a mark of awakening. And we see that. But there's some fairly odd ones in there as well. Webbed fingers and toes. So anybody's got webs between their fingers. Oh, doing a Spock here. So anybody's got webs, well, maybe you're on your way to being a Buddha. Well, hopefully we all are. And there's some other fairly odd ones in there as well. Certain marks on the feet, the soles of the feet, and sometimes you will see in certain countries there, you've seen the pictures of the feet, and there are various crosses and things. Things that look like reverse swastikas, for example. A totally different meaning, of course, to what we take a swastika to mean. Some other very odd characteristics, which I can leave you to use the search engine of choice to look up should you want to do that. You know, they're interesting, and I'm not exactly sure how they've evolved, but that they don't appear in the early suttas as far as we can tell, along with lots of other things as well. You know, the other story, the Buddha emerging virtually as a small baby, but fully formed, and being able to walk seven steps and, you know, point to the various directions of the compass and say, I alone am the awakened one. Probably part of mythology, I suspect. The idea that a baby would be able to get up and do that. But many traditional Buddhists would say, no, that's absolutely as it is. You know, we have these rituals of bathing the baby Buddha. Many of you people have done that too. They're very lovely rituals. So this is part of the mythology or cosmology of, in my language, of Shakyamuni Buddha. Now, what I've just said would be offensive to some traditional Buddhists, because for them it's not mythology. It is actual fact. And it's taken as fact. And so I just emphasise here again that this is my view, and I don't want to upset anybody here, and I certainly don't want to be going back to your parents or grandparents and saying, well, this guy who's meditated a lot said X. It's just going to be insulting. So it's not my intention to do any of that. We're putting out propositions, that's all, really. So we hold these lightly. Look, and these are, finally, these, my opinions, your opinions, they're just views. And the Buddha had a view about views. He called them a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a tangle of views. We get caught up in them. You know, we become stuck with our views, like being stuck in a thicket. So we know that the Buddha was born to this somewhat wealthy family in this republic-style place of northeast India, southwestern Nepal. And interestingly, and again, it's evolved into a mythology, but it's fairly predictable that Shakyamuni was destined to take over the family business. You know how dads groom their sons to take over the family business? Well, he was meant to take over the family business. And there are lots of stories about how dad, you know, pampered him and kept him away from the world and so forth. But underneath that is, you know, he was slated for a company business with dad and to take over eventually. But of course, we know that Shakyamuni, in his late 20s, decided to not take over from dad. The story goes that he was married and had a son called Rahula. We're not even sure if that's actually accurate. But then he decided to leave home, and I'll talk about that in a minute, because I think it's a central part of Buddhism that most Buddhists would say, yes, that something like this has probably happened. It's hard to know exactly what. At this point, this is where we usually get a few Westerners who get a bit riled up, because he left his wife and child. Something to grapple with. So that first retreat I told you about that I was on, the Burmese sidor, a very revered sidor, a very well-practiced sidor, teacher, senior teacher, spoke about the Buddha leaving home, and he spoke about it in a very approving tone. You know, like, we should agree with him. Isn't it great that he left his wife and child? Smart move, Buddha. You know, way to go, Shakyamuni. And, of course, you could feel the ripple of sort of, you know, pushback from the Westerners in the room. Nobody was impolite enough to say, that's dreadful, how dare he abandon his wife and child. There's lots of ways of thinking about that and what it means to be married today as opposed to what it might have meant to be married back then, and so forth and so on. We don't want to pause too long with that. But, you know, there's another point of difference that might separate us from other Buddhists, even around us in this room as well. I don't want to get into a debate about the morality of him leaving home or not, but there's a question in there too. So we move to this thing that's called the renunciation, or the great renunciation, and many of you will know about this because it is a stock standard central part of Buddhism, right from early Buddhist texts. So there are a number of different stories around the reasons for the renunciation, and truthfully, we don't actually know if any of them are true. Truthfully, we don't know if they're true. That's a good sentence, isn't it? So the story that all of us will probably know, many of us will know, is the story of seeing the four sights. Most of us would have heard that one. For those who haven't, just to gloss over it very quickly, it's said that Shakyamuni led this somewhat sheltered life, and then he decided to go out to one of the quarters or sides of the town, if you like, with his, sometimes called a charioteer or companion and so forth, servant. And he went to one of the quarters of the city, and he saw these people who looked very odd. He hadn't really seen this before and in such obvious ways. And he said to the his companion, you know, what's that? And they said, well, that's people who are old, frail, you know, struggling to walk around, perhaps twisted in body and so forth. And Shakyamuni goes, oh, this is, you know, a shock to him, supposedly, an existential shock. Well, a shock about existence, the nature of human existence. Well, oh, and does this happen to everybody? Yes. And, of course, it would have been absolutely everywhere. We tend to hide it away these days, in the West anyway. But this would have been everywhere, a common sight. Does it happen to everybody? Yes, it does. Will it happen to me? Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Pause for reflection. Back home. Trying to digest that. It said he went out sometime later, another day or so, to another quarter of the city. And he saw people who were even more frail and very odd-looking, dreadful-looking skin, all sorts of sores and ulcers and so forth and so on, limbs missing perhaps. And he said to his companion, my gosh, what's that? And the companion said, these are sick people. And of course he asked the same question, does this happen? Is this universal? Does it happen to everybody? And the answer, of course, must be, yes, it does. And will it happen to me? Yes, it will. Now, again, I work in a hospital, as some of you know, and I know that to some extent, I won't say we hide that level of sickness away, but we can put it out of sight for longer, whether it's in a hospital or an aged care facility of some sort. And it's hard to bear to look at that. It's very hard to bear. We tend to the instinct is to look away from that suffering. It's distressing. But interestingly, Shakyamuni looked at it, or is said to have looked at it and said, okay, it's going to happen to me, it happens to everybody, I see. Back home. Sometime later, back out again. And of course, you can see where this is going. He sees, you know, probably goes to what's called a charnel ground, maybe bodies lying around, graves and so forth, maybe funeral pyres. If anybody's been to India, down to the Ghats, you'll have seen the burning bodies, or indeed to parts of Indonesia as well, too. And of course, Shakyamuni asked the same questions. What's this? And clearly it was death. These are people who have died. And we need to remember here, and this is not for us to get too caught up, and these are people who are probably decomposing as well. That is something we definitely don't see these days. It formed a part of later Buddhist practice for certain ordained people, but not for lay people for various reasons. And does it happen to everybody? Yes, it does. Will it happen to me? Yes, it will. Okay, and on his final trip out to the other quarter of the city, it's said that Shakyamuni saw a wandering shramana. Now, shramana, or samana, is a We could call them a yogi, I suppose, a practitioner of yoga. But yoga here is not just doing the physical poses, it's mental cultivation as well. In fact, what we call yoga these days is hatha yoga, and originally was an absolutely minor part of what yoga is, in my reading anyway. It was much more mental cultivation. And he gets the idea, oh, this is a way of freeing myself, of going more deeply into what it means to be human, of maybe speaking to what's most important in life, given all these three realities that I've just seen, these universal realities. And it's said that he then went forth from home into the homeless life, is the way that it's put. And you may well have seen pictures or even figures of Shakyamuni holding up the long hair, which is a sign of wealth because you get to look after it, with a sword and cutting it through and getting rid of the long hair. This is the genesis of the shaving of the head, the going forth ritual. I've done it myself as a what they call a practice monk. And it's a getting rid of, I guess, one part of potential vanity, something we need to look after and think about. But it has a religious significance of going forth into the homeless life, whether that's for 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, or the rest of your life, for men and women too. So that's one story. And of course the Buddha then gives his clothes to a very, very happy beggar on the way out, takes his clothes and off the Shakyamuni goes into the next stage of life, which I'll talk about in a tick. And I want to tell you a very mythological story, but I like telling it so much I'm going to tell it anyway. It may not be central to all the traditions, because it tells us something about what I think Buddhist practice is in terms of what we might be able to agree on amongst various Buddhist traditions. However, back to before he's left home, there are several other depictions of what caused Shakyamuni to leave home, and I want to read you one of those. That's from the Majjhima Nikaya, this collection of the middle-length discourses, the Majjhima, number 26. And I'll just read you a little bit of it. And he's talking to a gathering of monks. So he's the Buddha at this stage, reflecting back on when he was still Shakyamuni. He says, "Monks, bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, being myself subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, to sorrow, to defilement, I sought what was subject to birth, aging, sickness, to death, to sorrow and defilement." So before he woke up, became awakened, became the Buddha, the one who sees, the one who knows, the one who is awake, he was very much chasing, if you like, things that were very much part of the world, that were subject to sickness, to death, to sorrow. That is, things that you couldn't hold on to, that, you know, in a sense are going to let you down sooner or later. That's, given our current society, that's something very interesting for us to reflect on, I think. And I'll come back to that. But he goes on to say, "Then I considered thus, why, being subject to birth and all the others and to defilement, should I seek what is subject to birth and so forth? Suppose that being myself subject to birth, old age, sickness and death, and having understood the danger in what is subject to birth and so forth, I seek the unborn." And he means nirvana here, or nibbana. "The supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Suppose that being myself subject to aging, sickness and death, to sorrow and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless and undefiled state. The supreme security from bondage," this is bondage to all those things we just mentioned, "nibbana or nirvana." So seeking something which is not subject to those things. So those words, unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, they're all synonyms for nirvana. And I come back to why we use synonyms a lot. And even nirvana is a synonym. A synonym, a word that is like another word, that reminds us of another word, similar to. So there are a number of different ways of thinking about Shakyamuni leaving home. So it's really important here, if we're looking at what unifies potentially, you know, Buddhists and Buddhisms across the various parts of the world and amongst all the different people, to look at this central story, because this is a central story in most traditions of Buddhism. It's accepted as fact by many people. So my reading of it as a Westerner in the 21st century is that what it speaks to is a word that I mentioned before, and that is existential issues. Existential The beginning part of the word is existence. So these are questions about what it means to be a human being, where what it's worth to put our time into. What are we putting our time into? Will it sustain us? Is it wholesome? Does it lead to wholesome things? These are questions of existence. Now, again, many of you know that I work as a bereavement counsellor in palliative care. And what that means is myself and a couple of other counsellors make ourselves available to people after somebody's died should they need extra support for various reasons. Now, again, I've got my own take on this and I'll view this with my own eyes and my own experience. But what I see brings people along, at least in part, are these very questions of existence. But they're not phrased in these highfalutin, philosophical, contemplative ways. They often come out in very simple ways, just everyday statements like, for example, a wife who's been happily married for 40, 50, 60 years, her husband dies. Men nearly always die before their wives or their partners, before the women. And they will commonly say things like, "What's the point of getting out of bed?" This is an existential question put in a very simple, everyday sort of way. What's the point of getting out of bed? Because if you've had a wonderful life, if a lot of your friends have died, the kids have moved away, if you had kids, and this is your life, getting older, sicker, without the person you love, what's the point of getting out of bed? Now, I don't want to depress anybody here, but it's often we only wait towards the end of our life or a big existential crisis that we ask these questions. My proposition, and again it's my view, is it's quite worthwhile reflecting on these questions when they're maybe not quite as urgent. You know, the Buddha did it in his 20s for some reason, and some people do. So my view is that the main motivating force for Shakyamuni to leave home was this question of what does it mean to be a human being, what is valuable, what's not valuable, how do I go about cultivating what's valuable, and letting go of what's not valuable. Where do I want to put my energy and time? Is it happening for me here and now? And if not, majorly that is, then it needs to be somewhere else. And so with perhaps that in mind, Shakyamuni set off as a shramana to investigate ways of being. So for the next 7 years, so this is like the extended university course for Shakyamuni. So this is the undergraduate and the master's degree and actually the PhD in his case too. He was obviously an advanced student, and in fact the texts say that he was an advanced student. So 7 years, it's said. Again, we don't know if that's accurate or not. That's the figure we're given. Seven has, in many cultures, a special religious significance as well, so it may well be that seven has crept in there. And there are lots of stories around the 7 years and so forth. But again, to gloss over that, it's something like Shakyamuni came across several different teachers of various yogic traditions, focusing more on practices of absorption, concentration, practiced with them, attained the levels they attained, and then for some reason felt that that wasn't still answering perhaps those questions that he'd set out to answer, that there was something more. It may well be that these practices focused on seeing the self as a problem and trying to get rid of the self. There's something solid in here. How do I work with that in a way that allows me to be more free? So one of the ways of working with that would be to, through meditation, achieve union with the higher power, for example. And certainly that can be part of yogic practices. My view, again, is that sets up the self as a problem, something to be battled against. You've already got a problem with the self. And part of the problem with those yogic practices is that, some of them, is that once you've come back from the yogic practice, what's left? A self. So it can become something that becomes even more of a problem, more refined, but perhaps more insidious, more of a problem. That might be one of the issues. I'm sure there are others as well. Some of the other practices that Shakyamuni took up were the ascetic practices, practices of self-denial, self-mortification. So again, if you go to India, you can still see some of these. These are practices of eating less, drinking less, not sleeping, standing up. Now, these practices are known throughout many Buddhist countries too, so this is a point of commonality as well. Scourging oneself, sitting out in the sun all day, or even imitating animals. And there's some, I was going to say charming, it's not quite the right word, some stories of a couple of ascetics coming to see the Buddha. These people are very sincere about their practice, and probably with high levels of absorption, concentration as well through their practice. And there's a couple of guys that came to see him, and one was doing the dog practices, and one was doing the cow practices. So in effect, what they were doing was, as a form of almost self-mortification, trying to get rid of this self through sort of rubbing it out through friction, they were basically doing what those animals would do. That's how they lived. And they came to the Shakyamuni, well, perhaps the Buddha at this stage, and said, so, what's the benefit of doing these practices? I'd say pretty clearly expecting a good answer, you're more fortunate rebirth and so forth. And I think it was the cow practice person that got answered first. And Buddha says, no benefit, you'll be reborn as a cow. And the same to the dog person, upon which they burst into tears. So an interesting response from the Buddha, a sort of fairly perhaps direct, but I would think perhaps compassionate response. Compassion doesn't always have to be soft, does it? In part, just to maybe a slight tangent, that story for me speaks to the power of habit. So we practice, we become. As we spend our days, so we spend our lives, Annie Dillard said. As we spend our days, so we spend our lives. What we practice, we become. And in going back to this notion of the brain, in a way, the brain doesn't really care what we do. If we do it over and over, that's who we become. That predominantly becomes us. If we practice greed or hatred, guess what? That becomes a very strong strand of our character. This is actually a very positive message, because the reverse is true. If we practice generosity, kindness, whatever form of meditation we might feel is appropriate if we're going to meditate, these things become who we are over time. This is the undergraduate and master's, and hopefully for you, PhD degree as well in Buddhist practice. These are views, maybe I phrase them slightly differently, but these will be shared amongst many Buddhists as well. So I'm still searching for these commonalities. That story I've just passed on to you, those stories, are also shared amongst many Buddhist cultures, Buddhist people as well. Now I'm going to tell you this little story that's not shared amongst all cultures, and it's told in lots of different ways, and it's more a product of Mahayana later scriptures, and there's a number of variations. I'm going to tell you my favourite. So it's said that Shakyamuni, having studied with these really well-developed masters, then went his own way, did the ascetic practices for many years as well with a group of ascetics. And eventually, seeing that these practices pretty much led to pain and suffering and almost certainly death, particularly restricting food and water and so forth. And there's very, very graphic depictions of this in the early suttas, in the Theravada suttas, or the Pali suttas, I should say. And you can read them for yourselves if you want to. It said Siddhartha went off and sat under a tree and reflected on what would help him achieve awakening. It said he sat under a rose apple tree, which is certainly a cosmological addition, because the rose apple tree, I believe, is a very ancient symbol of India itself. So we might say a Bodhi tree as well. And we know Bodhi trees are planted around the world because we see them as being Buddhist. In fact, they're called Ficus religiosa, the religious fig. That's the name of the Bodhi tree. You see, many figs have the same shaped leaves as the Bodhi tree as well. So, it said Shakyamuni was sitting there and he came to some conclusions about what was needed in terms of reaching awakening, the unborn, the unconditioned and so forth. And the story goes that he's on his way there. It's falling into place. And we must think at this stage that his meditative abilities would be superior. He spent 7 years developing his meditation abilities. That's a long time to continuously do just one thing. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. And doing it very earnestly and intensively as well. So he's sitting there on his way to awakening, whatever that might be. And it's said that this character came to see him. Now this character is a famous figure in Buddhist scriptures. And again, this character is understood by most traditional Buddhists around the world and many Western as well. And this character is called Mara. Mara, M-A-R-A, Mara. Mara is not the devil figure. Mara is actually a quite a high being. Mara is the lord of this world, runs the conditioned world. It's in Mara's interest that we all stay mired in conditionality. So Mara represents the conditioned world. In more traditional ways of speaking about Mara, Mara is the tempter, more akin to sort of a devil figure or a demonic figure, something like that. A trickster, maybe a bit like Loki. Okay? This is Mara. I don't think that makes the Buddha Thor, so I, you know. So like Loki, like a trickster. And what Mara sees is here's, we've got Shakyamuni meditating on the way to being liberated from this conditioned world, this conditioned ways of being in the world. Becoming, as it were, deconditioned on the way to becoming the Buddha, the one who wakes up. It's in Mara's interest not to have anybody wake up because, you know, that's one less subject in his world and possibly with others to follow. So this is a concern because Shakyamuni is a very impressive figure who clearly is going to have a profound impact on a lot of people, such that they'll start leaving Mara's realm as well. His power starts to dissipate. So Mara goes, okay, got to work on this guy, stop this from happening. What does Mara do? He sends in his armies. Now these armies, and this is probably a thing we wouldn't do in a political correct 21st century, are all misshapen and horrible and so forth. Orcs, trolls, that type of thing. One of your favourite sci-fantasy movies, that's what he sends in. But what's really interesting, I think, about this particular story, whether you believe it's true or not, is the way Siddhartha managed this avalanche of aggressive, destructive forces coming at him. And in our language, in the 21st century, we would say these are forces of the mind that distract us, disturb us. These are the forces of anger, aversion, hatred. So this is what's been unleashed in this very graphic way in this story. How does Shakyamuni handle them? Does he get up and fight them? No, he's not Thor. What he does do is to say, Mara, I know you. I know you. Now, isn't that interesting? Three words, I know you. What does he know? Well, what we read into this and take from this is that Siddhartha knew these powers. He was familiar with the forces of hatred, of aversion. And in knowing them, what happened? Well, in this mythological scenario, the army dropped all their weapons and just ran, fled the field of battle. So what we understand from this is that it's the clear seeing, the knowing, the being present to, the non-reactive, the wisdom of insight here that doesn't allow those things to attack, that doesn't give them any force. By opposing, they push back. But by seeing clearly and, as it were, almost like disengaging, I know you, there is no purchase space. They can't get a foothold. There's nowhere to go and they just dissipate. So I think that's a very interesting first part of this story. That's the armies of Mara, the forces of aversion. Mara the trickster's a bit discombobulated by this, but he says, okay, I'm not going to give up yet. I'm going to send in the shock troops. Okay, enough of the mucking around here. I'm sending in my three daughters, Lust, Pining and Delight. This is the heavy armor here, the heavy troops. Now these daughters have different names, different traditions, but these are my favourite names. So clearly, these are the forces of craving, of wanting, of grasping, of extreme sensuality. You know, all this stuff that floods the mind and, you know, floods the internet as well. So he sends in the three daughters. Now, when I first started thinking about this and maybe thinking about using this story, which is a long time ago, I thought, okay, lust and delight. I get how they'd unsettle the mind. I get that. We all get that. Lust and delight. Well, the mind just goes right off. You know, there's no steady, calm, presence-centered mind that's capable of insight and discernment in there. What about this woman called Pining, this daughter called Pining? Pining is when we pine for something, we want something. Yearning would be another word. Now, again, to come back to my profession, I see this a lot. And you must have experienced more minor versions of this. You know when something happens and we haven't been able to stop it, it's been an unpleasant thing? how the mind can go back and we go, oh my God, if only I hadn't said that, or if only I had said that, if only I'd done more, if only I'd done less, if only I hadn't been there, if only I had been there. Well, in my profession, I hear that a lot. You can imagine when somebody dies, that there are the regrets that we have, and people tend to think, oh my God, I could have, should have, and they confuse should and could. I should have is confused with I could have. They also forget they've got the wisdom of hindsight. They know exactly how things have panned out, and of course we can all be wise after the event. But I would propose to all of you that we all do that. We all know this daughter pining to a greater or lesser extent. And for those who are hetero amongst us, or indeed otherwise, it might be a male. Pining might be a male as well. It doesn't really matter. It's the force of pining or yearning. If only, if only, if only I won lotto, then I'd be happy. So on retreat, I tell a little story about a guy I met many years ago in Thailand on a retreat, a long retreat. Very intense meditator. Very dedicated young bloke. He was probably about 27, so similar age to Shakyamuni. And he would go out and meditate in the forest. This is in southern Thailand. And the forest, even then, that I was... You know, there's lots of not much forest left, I suppose. It had snakes. Certainly, I confronted a few in the toilets. The snakes just sort of sitting there looking at you. Dogs, pretty much almost wild dogs, and so forth and so on. Lots of things that want to bite you, basically. But he would go out and meditate there, maybe come back for one meal and go back again. So a lot of courage as well and persistence. So he came to see the head monk, Ajahn Buddhadasa, a very famous Thai monk. And basically, I was told, like I heard later, rolled out his experience in front of Ajahn Buddhadasa, basically asking, was that an awakening experience that I had when I was out there meditating for all those days and nights? And I believe that Ajahn Buddhadasa, in his very direct yet compassionate way, said no. No. And so this guy is obviously disappointed, a bit crestfallen, he's tried so hard. He came back, and I remember we were sitting in one of the dormitories just talking about this. And he said something very interesting, which I think absolutely speaks to this idea of grasping onto what we didn't get or what we do want in the future, grasping onto who we think we can be, who we think we are, you know, this yearning quality that we have. He said, you know what, I thought that if I practice really hard, by the time I was 30, I'd become enlightened. And that's interesting enough. And then he said something that was really telling, and then he said, and then I'd be able to relax. So the sting in the tail was what was driving him. My view would be he needed to turn towards what was pushing him along. What are the forces, pining, the armies, you know, aversion, craving and so forth? What were the forces underneath that this striving was being pushed along by? If only. So I see pining as the if only daughter. If only I can get good marks in my exams, then my parents will be happy, and then they'll get off my back, you know, or then they'll buy me the car. So often there's a sting in the tail that actually tells us what's pushing us along. And actually Buddhism is a practice, at least in part, of uncovering what's going on for ourselves. I'll come back to that a little bit later. So this is my story of lust, pining and delight. It doesn't end there though, because of course what does Shakyamuni do? He says exactly the same thing. I know you, Mara. So four words. I know you, Mara. And of course, for the same reasons, the daughters flee the field. So Mara's got one last roll of the dice here to try and stop Shakyamuni from becoming a the Buddha. He challenges him. By what right do you claim to be on the way to awakening? And it's said that the Shakyamuni touched the earth and called the earth to witness his right to move into awakening and become the Buddha. And it's said that the earth trembled and all sorts of things happened as well. And again, some people believe those stories quite literally. For others, it's like me, it's more symbolic. What I read into that is this is a birthright of human beings. This awakening is something that is natural as being here on this earth. And you'll see these very beautiful figures of the Buddha in various mudras. And one of them is with one of the hands touching the earth. And this is what it represents, this awakening and coming into, full awakening. And it said that that's what happened. Mara then had nothing left and fled the scene. and Shakyamuni became the Buddha. And he's said to have realized a number of things, his own many lives, rebirth, and so forth. So a number of things in there that he's said to have realized. Again, some people believe it literally. Some would say that people have just taken what they think the essence of the Dharma is and put it into the awakening experience. So, for example, many Westerners would say, well, they just dismiss the fact that rebirth might have been part of his own many lives and so forth, might have been part of the Buddha's experience. Go, well, that's irrelevant to me. So I'll put it out there for you to have a think about and explore further if you want to. So now we have Shakyamuni's gone from leaving home until about 7 years later has come to awakening as the Buddha. So is awakening or nirvana something that all Buddhists would agree on? Is this part of this introduction to Buddhism, this thing that we can all say, oh yes, that's definitely Buddhist, it's shared by most people? Well, yes and no, I'd say. I'd say that many Buddhists, in my experience and my reading, would want to acknowledge there is such a thing as awakening. They might argue as to what it is, and I'll come back to that. What they might disagree about is the historical facts around it. The stories I've just told you, they might disagree about those. But that this idea of awakening is embedded right throughout the whole of Buddhism, really. It takes on different forms, I think, down through the centuries. But it's definitely there as a strand amongst most major forms of Buddhism. So this does leave us with this question, doesn't it? That what is nirvana? What is awakening? Can we say something about that? It's a very bold person who tries to say anything about that at all. So I'm going to be semi-bold and just touch on a few ideas and then leave it up to you to discover for yourself. So I mentioned this word synonyms before. There's lots of synonyms. One of the ways it's spoken about then is this quenching of the flames of greed, hatred, and ignorance or delusion, of craving, aversion, and ignorance. It quenches the flames of craving and aversion through seeing clearly, through understanding how things really are. So it's the practice of seeing what causes suffering, what causes us to suffer, to stay within this conditioned realm, to be caught up with things that finally aren't going to totally or completely satisfy us, or think that they're going to, and not see the nature of things is that they all slip away, they change. So seeing that and being released from suffering. There's a very useful word here. I've mentioned it to some of you before. The word here, the Pali word, is upadana. It's a word that actually means grasping, clinging onto something. So we know about craving, which is tanha, which literally means thirst. When we thirst after experiences of any sort, internal or external, we get sort of caught up with it. But this is the next one along that wheel of dependent origination, which is clinging, hanging on to that thing that we've got and desperately not wanting to lose it. You know, we get a nice new car and the first scratch is always the deepest, don't you think? It's just dreadful, especially with these large four-wheel drives going around, you know. That's a whole pet topic of mine that I won't get into because I'll be coming up with some aversion about it. That first scratch is the deepest, okay? So we'd want to desperately stop it from happening. You know, difficult to do because the world is a scratchy place, both on the outside and the inside in terms of relationships, objects and so forth. So upadana. Now upadana, interestingly, this clinging, it relies on a fuel. It has to burn on something. So it's sort of burning. Remember I talked about these flames that need to be quenched. So it burns according to a fuel. And the fuel, let's take a common example. We have lots of different sorts of fires. Recently we've had fires in Australia. We could say we've got grass fires. The fuel there is grass. We can say we've got a bushfire, so you need the forest to have a bushfire. And so we can have a gas fire. Gas is the fuel. So this craving also depends on something. Fortunately, because if it depends on something, then we've got an answer about what to do, this clinging. We just need to make sure we don't have the fuel there. We see the fuel and we don't set fire to it. So for example, we can have a fire that's based on anger. And that might sound odd because anger is an unpleasant thing. But I'll put to you that maybe sometimes we like being angry, that self-righteous anger. You know, to go back to cars again, if somebody cuts us off in the traffic, Or indeed, if we let somebody in, they don't acknowledge that we've let them in. We like to be angry. You know, that person, create a story. So we add suffering to our anger. So this is a fire that burns on the fuel of anger. And we can start thinking about all sorts of unpleasant things. And we can say there are fires. We can also say there are fires built on lust or craving. You know, as I said before, a few seconds, you know, focus on the internet to see what it's predominantly made up of. We can see there's a lot of lust and craving there. If you've got social media, there are a lot of polarizing views on social media where people seem to attack each other for not agreeing completely with what they've said. This is both craving and clinging. Clinging to the idea that everybody should agree with me. And if they don't, that other person's wrong. Well, that's an agitation. That's a sort of, and fire is seen to be very agitated in Buddhist cosmology. So the more, and again, the more we feed those fires, the more they become ingrained, the more they're likely to flare up. You know, as we do, so we become. As we've done, so we are. You know, this is the sort of idea of underlying karma in this life. It builds up a whole self. We can work with it, fortunately, because fortunately everything's changing. If it wasn't, we'd have real trouble. We'd be stuck with everything just as it is. May or may not be a good thing. So the way I phrase this sometimes is, we need to see what's going on. When we see what's going on, that these fires are agitated and there's a cause of the fires, craving or aversion, then simply by being present to them, we know that they burn. Now, this is analogous to sticking your hand in a fire. If anybody's put their hand on a hot grate or a stove or into the fire, you don't need somebody to say to you, do you know, I wouldn't pick up that hot ember out of that coal out of the fire, because you're probably going to, you've already burned your hand, it's stuck to your hand, you're going to have to try and dig the thing off your hand. When you know for yourself what causes suffering, there's an automatic reaction that goes, I don't need to pick that up. But that's a choice we can only make when we see clearly what's going on. So there's something in Buddhism across the board about waking up to the way things are. And in doing that, it's said that we're released to greater and greater levels from suffering, the suffering of ignorance, not seeing how things are. The suffering of being dictated to by craving or aversion, pushed around by craving or aversion. We're not constructed by all our habits anymore. So another synonym for nibbana, is the asankhata. The asankhata. A meaning not, the not conditioned, or the unconditioned. I quite like not conditioned because it's much more grounded than unconditioned. Sounds like a mystical place out there. But the not conditioned, what is it not conditioned by? It is not conditioned by ignorance. It is not conditioned by craving. It is not conditioned by aversion. So this is a more approachable understanding of nirvana. Wonder what that would be like, to be present in such a way that we're not conditioned by those forces which undoubtedly we've been conditioned by, that we're not subject to Mara. We're not being pushed around by Mara, his armies or daughters. The problem here, of course, is that once we start talking about the unconstructed, anything we say about it is, guess what? Constructed. Anything I say is a construction. It's a verbal construction. It's a story. So whenever we talk about nirvana, we can't actually touch the thing itself, because it's the it is an experience, if you like, or a process of the unconstructed in the way we're talking about. It's the unconstructed in the sense that we come to see that this self is being constructed moment by moment, or day by day, or week by week. It just depends on how macro our view is and how minute the view becomes. So in seeing that this self in our experience is a product of causes and conditions to which we also contribute, there is some work. We can see how we can start working with our experience. But to say anything definitive about the unconstructed is impossible. We can put up signposts. We can put up flyers about nirvana. But these are really, they're the map. They're not the territory, right? The territory is the experience. It's the knowledge. It's the understanding. But we need a map. However, each of you, and this comes back to where I started with the talk, will have to construct your own map, drawing from, you know, sources like maybe the talk tonight, from talking with your friends, from what you bring from home, from your prior understanding, from what you want it to be for you into the future. You will construct a map. Now, that map might be very similar to other people's maps, not exactly the same. And the territory you traverse must be your own territory, ehipasiko. It doesn't mean there's not points of commonality, many, many points of commonality, which I've touched on this evening a little bit. But these are still only maps. They're signposts. And we will keep constructing the maps as we understand more deeply and as we move further into reflection and so forth. And what happens here, in a way, we can talk about nirvana as an unbinding, a releasing. And what's unbound is really ignorance. It's this misunderstanding of what the self is and what happiness is and what it isn't. What's trustworthy, what's not trustworthy. So this is another way of thinking about nirvana. There's the quenching of the flames. There's the unconstructed or unbinding, the not constructed. Now, I saw two ways of speaking about the awakening experience, if I can put it that way. And they're a bit wordy, but I'll talk about them both because I think they do point to some ways of thinking about this awakening experience that might help us forge an idea of what we want to be doing, maybe with this thing called Buddhism. Okay, there's two types of unity. So this is the author's words. The first one is called annihilational unity. That is, annihilation is to disappear completely, to be wiped out. Annihilational unity, and they say of that, connection to the subjective experience of self-loss. Connection to the subjective experience of self-loss. I'll come back to that. The second one is what they call relational unity. Connection to other people in the environment beyond the self. So one is a sort of loss of self, the subjective sense of self, and the other one is a fear. It's somewhat similar, but there's much more sense of openness, expansion to other people, and a dissipation or fading of what normally feels like the boundaries, the skin boundaries or the psychological or emotional or social boundaries of myself. The first one, I think, relates to some meditation experiences that are talked about in a lot of the different suttas and sutras, and that is the experience of the mind, as it were, turning away from any sort of construction of self. And this can happen in a number of ways, through an absorption practice and a moment of release from any sort of knowing any conditionality. It can also happen through insight, through seeing the construction and the unsatisfactoriness of the construction at very minute levels, and the mind turning away because of that. So for me, what they're meaning here, as far as I can understand, is that experience. They're calling it annihilation, but we know in Buddhism that Buddhism is not into annihilationism at all. It's not into complete sensuality, because it puts the self as a problem. I've got to annihilate something. Hang on, from Buddhist perspective, isn't there in the way we think it is? Why set up a problem when there isn't one to start with? The only problem is we misperceive what's actually going on. Let's not create another problem and go, oh, this self, I've just got to get rid of it. You know, get into a bit of self-loathing and self-hatred. So I'd advise caution on using the word annihilation. But this idea of release, or unity as they call it, to the subjective experience of self-loss, it's a little mysterious, isn't it? But this sense that the sense of self dissipates. There's no subjective experience of self, or indeed any discernible, conscious, subjective experience. I hope that's not too mysterious. I hope it is mysterious and you strive towards it. That would be okay too. And the other one is this relational unity. And there are many different Buddhist practices that lead to this sense of relational unity. And my proposition to you would be that a commonality amongst traditions is the idea of absorption practice, which we might call jhana. This is what Shakyamuni learned from his yogic teachers. And it's the absorption into or through the mind becoming unified by paying attention to one predominant object, such as the breath, or indeed pleasant feeling, is another great way of practicing this. This is not a million miles from our own experience. if you've ever had a feeling of pleasure from doing something that pulls your attention together and unifies it, playing guitar, swimming, playing sport, looking at a sunset, anything that unifies our sense of experience can lead to the sort of the outer edges of this experience they're talking about here. So it's a normal human experience, it's just intensified, it's a skill that's developed in jhana practice. And there are a number of different forms of jhana. That would be found in many, many different Buddhist traditions as well. How that fits in with Vipassana, of course, there's been a long question over about the last 2,000 years. And up until recently, I'd say Vipassana was the one that was talked about most, insight meditation. Jhana is quite rightly making a re-emergence. So there's a couple of different meditation practices that might tell us something about they're sort of lengthy synonyms for nirvana, I suppose, in a way. They're sentence synonyms for nirvana and practices. So we know with all of that anyway that Buddhism spread out through through north and south and up through places I've mentioned before, like China and Tibet, through Mongolia, and down through into Vietnam and so forth, where it met up with the other form of Buddhism coming through Sri Lanka, Burma, and parts of Cambodia, what developed into Theravada Buddhism, the school of the elders. And so there's an interesting blend of Buddhism in those areas as well. And many other countries I've just left out there, but very broadly. I don't want to talk about that too much, because that's just something you look up, and it's not in dispute that that's what happened. That actually is what happened. There's no dispute amongst any Buddhists about where Buddhism spread to. They might dispute the forms of Buddhism and what people do. In fact, that has happened. People get very sniffy about their own forms of Buddhism and what it actually is. But the historical spread of Buddhism is just, it's just a given, an absolute given. Usually along the Silk Road and down through south through India and up through and across to Sri Lanka and so forth. So what I'd say here then, and bringing this to a close, maybe we can then maybe talk a bit more. In my view, Buddhism is cultural. Clearly we can't escape culture. There is a culture in this room right here. We might not normally think about it that way, but there is. Maybe an emerging culture of some sort. So it's certainly cultural. It's certainly social, and it should be social as well. Right from the early days, Buddhism has been, although a solitary practice, there's always been a social element. Even in the time of the Buddha, who was, you know, very much a recluse, somebody who spent a lot of time by himself, still had to be fed, go on alms round. Right from the very first, after the awakening experience, before the awakening experience, you still need to interact with society. And there are many, many instances of the Buddha talking to various people who approached him about, you know, who are you, what do you do, what does it mean to be you, what's this nirvana thing you're talking about, you know, and the Buddha would try and address himself to those people at in a way that he thought was appropriate to them. Another aspect of Buddhism that's pretty much agreed on is the so-called eightfold path, which we can gloss as sila, samadhi and punya, that is living a life that is based on decent values, generosity, kindness and so forth. Underneath that is really this idea of not harming ourselves or others. It's central to most religions, actually. Samadhi is a concentration, absorption. So it's meditation. It's a word for meditation. Panya is insight or wisdom, either as a meditative experience or indeed as a reflective experience, an experience about contemplating what life is about and what it's for and what we want to do with it. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So there's broad agreement across the Buddhist traditions, the Buddhist diaspora or world, that forms a part of Buddhist practice. Some of these lists were probably compiled after the Buddha. Convenient things were put together. But there's just a shared agreement about these things as well. So there's an interesting point here for me, and this is something that maybe we lost a bit in the transition from Buddhism, from traditional Buddhist countries to the West, and that is that the Buddhist practice is a profoundly moral tradition. That is, each element of those three aspects of the path I mentioned should interact with each other and should lead to a life that is, as I said, a life of generosity, kindness, decency, and so forth, right here and now, towards ourselves and towards others. And now I would go so far as to say, if you're doing a meditation practice, if you think that's part of the Buddhism you want to do, then if it's not tied in with some sense of softening of the self and opening up to others in this way that is far more generous and connected, I would say it's not Buddhist practice, because it's not part of the Eightfold Path. So if it's leading away from that to selfishness, to greed, to exalting one's own states of meditation, for example, my proposition, and again I say it's me, it doesn't have to be you, I would say it's not Buddhist. Absolutely not. And I've become clearer and clearer about that as I've aged a bit more. People use meditation for all sorts of things. And we even read about in the suttas, like Milarepa, the famous Tibetan yogi, used meditation as a sort of a sorcerer and a wizard, and then spent the rest of his life practicing in what we'd say is a more Buddhist type of way, and became revered as a saint. But what drove him there was all these wrong deeds through using magic and, you know, sort of concentrative powers to, you know, achieve his own ends. Definitely not Buddhist meditation, the first part of that. So the Eightfold Path is important, and it all needs to work together. For me, I would say a central part of the practice is about reflecting on what it means to be a human being. I think I've made that fairly clear. Now, whether that amounts to, yes, what I'm doing in terms of going along to temple, to making offerings, that's a decent thing to do. That may be what you do. That may be your very macro reflection. It fits into the culture and it's a decent thing. You may move right down to a very micro, sort of atomistic approach, which is to investigate your experience through precise meditation practices, but it's still investigation. It's still reflecting on what my experience is. So whether it's at a village level, a cultural level, a town level, whether it's at an individual meditative level, moment by moment, for me, one of the central tenets of Buddhism is reflecting on what it means to be human. And I take that back to where we started with this talk, with those stories of Shakyamuni in his late 20s going, this life is not satisfactory for me at the moment the way it is. There's various reasons why, and I need to explore those in some sort of way such that I can be truer to what I think or know is a better way of living. So for me, this is also a shared understanding amongst Buddhist traditions. It plays out differently, it expresses itself differently, and it doesn't always, and typically, traditionally, hasn't always meant meditation. This is a challenge for Westerners, because if we say it's not necessarily about the meditation, really? What's it about then? So that's where I'm going to close, I think, my little bit. Thank you for your attention and listening and so forth. I appreciate that. We have some time for conversation if you would like to. I hope I've given you the sense of freedom to say anything, because your view is your view, and it's important that you have some sense of what that is. I can't hope to answer your questions, but I can comment on them if you like and put my 2 cents worth in. So we have a little time now if you'd like to say anything or add something or challenge me on something if you want. That would be perfectly acceptable too. I look forward to it. So, thoughts, questions?
Can you repeat the name of Marasnatha?
Oh, these are the 3 names that I like. The English translations are lust. So lust is craving, you know, sexual craving, but more sensual craving. More, you know, it might be for another croissant or, more dessert or sticky date pudding or whatever your thing happens to be. You know, sensual craving. But it's more than just enjoying an ice cream. It's so much more than that. It's the sense that I get one and I need more, and I better stop other people from getting it because they're not enough to go around. It's that level of enmeshment in craving. So it's more than just enjoying something. I'd like to think that a Buddha can enjoy a gelato if he was here amongst us. But if he didn't get the gelato, I wouldn't fuss him either, I don't think. So this is lust. Craving, maybe, is a better word. At the other end, is delighting in something. Oh, isn't it wonderful? And especially if built around the self, I'm pretty good. You know, press that 150 Ks today at the gym. Make sure I can just subtly tell people that maybe a selfie will do the trick. So selfies would be an example of maybe delighting, you know, that sort of thing, and maybe a little too much. Because it's comparative. Look at my life compared to yours. And often it's very generous. We just delight in sharing with people. That's fine. But the thing that maybe is interesting is how much the self is being built up in all of that too. And the middle daughter, the one I talked about a bit more, was pining. Pining, yearning might be another word. I wish, if only. you know, if only I could be 6'2" and, you know, whatever, Thor. You know, we can have all of these, and we can spend a lot of time daydreaming about those. So we could say it's the daydream daughter if we wanted to. And these are just aspects of the mind from my perspective, and things that we see quite commonly in ourselves in very mundane sorts of ways, but things to watch out for. You know, who's driving this, us or them? So I mentioned to you a long time ago, I did a course many years ago called Zen Existentialism down in Melbourne. It was a great course, actually. It was a combination of a guy who was a philosopher and so forth talking about Zen Buddhism, but existentialism as well. And he said something that I've always remembered. It's such a simple thing. And it's often the simple things that stay with us, I think, the easy things to remember. He said, do you have your thoughts or do they have you? Do you have your thoughts or do they have you? Substitute the word. Do you have your emotions? Do you have your, you know, whatever it happens to be? Who's running the show, folks? And that's something that reflection, contemplation, conversation, meditation can reveal to us quite disturbingly sometimes. So slowly, slowly on this one. Do you have your thoughts or do they have you? So is that okay? That speaks to what you're asking? Yeah. You please, yeah.
If I am a Western, of course, like after being grow up in a Western Christian oriented society, the concept of lust has been like pretty much related to the concept of sin.
Mm.
Finally, the moral.
Yeah.
So our Western moral is like pretty much involved in that concept, lust, sin, regret.
Correct.
So could you help me like comparing this concept with the Buddhist Eastern concept of that lust?
I'll do my best, yeah. So this is the idea of lust, that in typically Western or indeed Christian cultures, it's been equated with sin. Now sin in many Christian traditions is equated with this body. The body is seen to be impure. So then if one indulges in bodily delights, one is going possibly down to hell, or one of the hells perhaps, and Buddhists have hells and heavens as well. Or if one manages to work around it, become more pure and so forth, one might then end up in heaven if one's lucky. There's lots of variations on that theme, but that's at the nub of it. The body is a problem. And if we go back to those early yogic traditions, for many of those yogic traditions, the ascetic practices, the body is the problem. It's impure. So it's not a million miles away. But sin is the idea in some traditions that we're born, and the very act of being born means that we're sinners. We're born impure, as it were. And we need all the rest of our lives to atone for the sin of being born human. Interesting way of looking at things. So in Buddhism, we will talk about lust or craving as well, and we want to be very clear that it's quite different. It's not seen as a sin. It's seen as a very normal part of being a human being. But when we use the word lust or craving, as I was saying before, it's beyond just enjoyment or pleasure, if you like. It's a heightened form of desire that's driven by not seeing that by indulging that, as it were, or practicing it, it becomes a habit, and so it becomes the driver. And so the mind, it's very hard to have a clear mind when we're driven by craving or by anger, for example, either. You try and talk to somebody who's angry, you know, it's not going to happen. But somebody is driven by craving for something. You know, they want that car spot and you're trying to get the car spot. That's the sort of craving. You know, you have the biggest punch-ups in the supermarket, in a parking lot, anywhere. We're driven by those things. And so it's not that it's a sin. It's not that we're born into sin, original sin, as it's called. There's a Buddhist teacher who says we're not born into original sin. There's no such thing as original sin in Buddhism. It's original ignorance. And it's this not seeing clearly how things are that leads to us becoming mired in those really oppressive habitual forces. So to get some space around them, even in conversation like this, talking with friends, through some meditation practices, gives us some space where we can start seeing more clearly what's going on. So lust is a word that I only use in the context of that story because it makes it a more interesting story. I would tend to avoid that because we have all these other issues about what it actually means, craving. again, some of you will have heard the story a few times, but it's a real story, unfortunately, about my grandfather who died many years ago. He went through a stage in his life, and I don't know why, where he needed to drink glasses of water. So he'd have one glass of water and it wouldn't be enough. He'd have another one and it wouldn't be enough. And so it would go on until he was sick. And guess what he would do after that? Have another glass of water. So like a compulsion, he couldn't stop it. Now, I don't actually know what got him out of that. Interesting, tanha, the word for craving, the Pali word for craving, means something like thirst. So we're thirsting, but we're driven by thirst, not just, oh, I'd like a drink of water, and having had a mouthful, I'm okay. I can have a gelato and that's fine. It's like that's conditioned my craving for more of the same, and then pushing others out of the way. The hardening of the sense of self, me, mine, getting, gaining, not losing, all of that construction of self sits underneath that and is fed by that. So that, those are those flames that burn then on that desire for those things that we want, often at the expense of others. Lust itself is not, in a sense, a sin. It's a foolishness, perhaps, an ignorance. It's understandable. You know, we don't want to condemn it as such, but to see it clearly is so important. So a different feeling about it, I think, too. A different way of approaching it as well, because we're not really relying on a creator being to come down and save us, and that's something else that most schools of Buddhism would share. Although we do have saints in Buddhism, and we can call on their name, and they're said to help and so forth in traditional forms of Buddhism. But the work here and now is for us to do it, for most schools of Buddhism. Does that speak to what you were saying? Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
it might be a weird question, but like...
Excellent.
I'm like very interested like in science.
Uh-huh.
And also I'm this Westerner.
Yeah.
Kind of live.
Excellent.
So I know like some people believe there's a relationship between like science, particularly physics, and like Buddhism.
Yep.
I don't know if you know something about that, like or relation, like you know, this connectivity to the universe, like this sense of mystics.
Yes.
I don't know if you know like something about that.
In terms of the neurology of what's going on, the biology of what's going on, yeah. There's a lot of research papers around that. When people in the past have spoken about or written about these mystical experiences and their relationship with the body or the brain or so forth, they've mostly been talking about the absorption style of practices, the ones where the mind becomes unified. And interestingly, maybe it's a paradox in a way, when the mind becomes unified or the attention becomes unified, maybe not use the word mind, it's a problematic word, there can be a felt sense of opening, of expansion. Now, as I said before, most of us here have experienced that when we're feeling good about the mind, the attention having been drawn predominantly to one thing over a period of time, and we're both relaxed and open but really present, it feels good emotionally, physically, and there can be a sense of being uplifted, I suppose, is another way of putting it. The different Buddhist traditions, and indeed all the different mystical traditions, will talk about it in slightly different ways. Some will talk about it as the union with God, typically out of Christian, or most other traditions actually. Buddhists wouldn't normally talk about it that way. They talk about the dissolution of self, the opening, or the feeling of relational unity I talked about before. The experimentation that's been done around a lot of meditation in terms of those mystical states has been done around absorption practices. There's a whole evolving field of what actually happens in meditation. So the typical experiments these days in relation to that are done with what are called fMRI machines, magnetic resonance imaging machines, functional magnetic resonance imaging machines. What they essentially do, I think, is measure the iron in the blood. Some of you here will know far more about that than I do. And what they do is they stuff people inside them and measure their brain waves and so forth. It's a little problematic because you never can really get inside somebody's head. You've still got to get... This is what we're reading out here, and there's a lot of work that goes to get a reading out in front of you. And here's what they say about what was happening when we did that reading. So there's still those two things that have to be put together. So, you know, it's early days on that as well. But there are some very interesting accounts of, you know, advanced meditators being put into these machines. So there's a famous French man who's a monk in the Tibetan tradition called Mathieu Ricard, And he was one of the most startling of the meditation subjects they put into the fMRI machine. You know, you have a normal curve and most of us fit into the bell curve somewhere. He didn't even fit in the bell curve. He was so far ahead of the game in terms of the various meditation practices. They had to reinvent the bell curve. So, you know, we know about outliers. Well, he was an extreme outlier. You know, years of practicing meditation. So there's quite a lot that can be read about it. And I guess it's fascinating and can really inform what we perhaps want to do with our practice or what it is that is going to assist us into the future. It's so fascinating to get caught up with that and forget about the application of it in everyday life too. So that's probably the other thing to bear, the balancing aspect of it as well. When Buddhism first came to the West, one of the predominant ways that it was introduced was through saying it's scientific. It's a religion of rationality, of enlightenment. In fact, the enlightenment comes from the Enlightenment, which is a period in Western history. Rationality, science, moving more towards measurement, the unity of mankind and so forth. Lots of very interesting ideas. And they pulled the word enlightenment and used it for the Buddha. So in many ways, the Buddha was seen as like a sort of an 18th century gentleman of the Enlightenment. You know, because we all remake the Buddha in our image. There's an example of it. We'll do it here tonight as well. We'll have an idea of what the Buddha is in some way and what he isn't. But Buddha just means to wake up. The root is something like to be awake. So enlightenment is a convenient term, but it's also a slightly mystifying term as well. There's some lovely literature to read around mysticism from the Christian mystics as well and from the Sufis as well, so Meister Eckhart and so forth. Really, really interesting stuff. And to know how to translate that in your mind into more Buddhist terminology is sort of interesting. But these are common human experiences. Henry James, over 100 years ago, the great pragmatist philosopher in America, William James, wrote about the varieties of religious experience, which is essentially talking with people about these experiences they had, which were mystical experiences. And we would recognise many of them in reading the Buddhist texts, or maybe having experienced them ourselves through meditation as well, William James. So, lots to read. Yeah, it's a great field.
Okay.
Yes, please, yeah.
Yeah, one particular perception of Buddhism is the fact that Buddhists are vegetarian. Now, I've done quite a lot of travelling in Thailand and Malaysia and Laos and Vietnam and Nepal, and that's complete rubbish.
Yep. It
just isn't.
Correct.
Now, you mentioned something about profound morality.
Yes.
Now, how does that fit in with the exploitation of these animals that cause extreme suffering?
Yep.
Just for sensory pleasure. So people can consume the flesh and the milk and the eggs and wear their skins and things.
Yes. Look, there's a number of different ways of coming at that, I think, and I can just sort of touch on maybe a few. Yeah. For many people, that's completely wrong and it should stop. And you can't be a Buddhist if you eat meat. That's certainly true. For a lot of Westerners would say that too, particularly, you know. And this goes right back to the historical Buddha as well. These, in a sense, arguments have been going on. As far as we can draw from the text, it seems like the Buddha chose not to be vegetarian. There seems to be some specific references, you know, throughout the tradition. And the reason I think why that is because on alms round, and I've been on alms round when I was a practice monk in Burma, for example, you accept what's given. And you don't have choice about that.
Now, I do remember asking a Buddhist monk about this. I sort of pushed it and said, well, what happens if I offer you human flesh?
Yes.
And
you would have to say, yeah, and there is a morality to that. Well, you wouldn't know unless they told you, would you? So I suppose that's one thing.
But the point was, they do seem to be able to refuse if they want to.
Yeah. There's things for the monks that would... there's a the whole code of rules for monks and nuns. And there's like 267 or something. And I have to confess, I haven't read through them all. And I don't know if it specifically says, you shall not eat human flesh. But given the thrust of Buddhism, which is connection with other, and this relational unity is one aspect of it, and the sense of, even in doing the meditation, of feeling more connected or less separated from others, it's going to be pretty hard to eat human flesh, knowing if you knew it was human flesh.
Well, yeah, I just said that.
Yeah.
flesh out the idea.
So to speak.
Yeah.
People always bring up extremes. It's the same with metta meditation when we're trying to, you know, send metta to all beings, and people always say, what about Hitler? It's like, well, perhaps we can start with a difficult person sitting next to us in the classroom. Let's put Hitler out there as, you know, something to aim towards, and maybe that's an argument. That might be one thing to think about. That would be one thing. There is also, if I draw on my experience in Burma, and this is not necessarily right or wrong, but just to say this is how I perceive it. I certainly, when I was there, didn't have any animal flesh at all, and that option was offered to me. But what I did see was when people got offered that, it was often very poor and very little of it. So when we think, and this is not a justification, but just to put it out there as what I perceive as a reality, when we think about eating meat, we think of a hefty, great steak, you know, a side of beef, you know, a roast lamb, you know, chickens that are ginormous these days, that sort of thing. And I'd dreadful say my mouth is watering when I'm telling you this. So, you know, that says something about me and my habits. But my experience in a number of different Asian countries is that's when they're not practicing vegetarianism, there's actually quite a small amount of animal flesh that goes with the bulk of things. When I was in Nepal many, many years ago, people would have on their plate, and many of you will have seen this in your own countries that maybe your parents or grandparents come from, that what predominantly is on the plate is vegetables, rice, fibrous things, and so forth. The little bits of meat that are there are often shared between people, and there's not very much offered. So if you're maybe, and I saw that in Nepal very much, people would have these plates piled high. You look at it and go, not much meat in the offering there. There's certainly not a steak smacked onto the side of that plate there. You know, it couldn't fit a steak on there. It was so full of this other food. So the volume is less. I mean, we're the first culture majorly to have these huge feedlots and so forth, and to be slaughtering animals on the you know, scale that we are. There are some countries where getting access to vegetables is far more difficult. I'll cite Tibet in relation to that. It's far more difficult. So there's a difficult choice to be made there as well. But yes, these are challenging choices. And I would say that it's for each of us to reflect on. We can look around the world and go, my gosh, how can they do that? That I don't think that's Buddhist. Well, by logical extension, if I don't think that's Buddhist and I want to regard myself as living by Buddhist principles, I should do the thing that I think you know, applies to Buddhists, that is, become vegetarian. So there's no one answer to your question. And we could get fixated, I'm not saying you are, we could get fixated on how bad the other Buddhists out there and they're not living, being true to the underlying principles, as it were, of Buddhist practice. But the practice actually comes back to us then. So, you know, we start with ourselves and we learn from that. For us, that's not acceptable. And sometimes travelling in some other countries, talking with other people, it refines what we do and don't think about the practice as well. So coming back to the varieties of Buddhism, I presume from what you're saying, those would be practices within a broader Buddhist diaspora that you wouldn't accept for yourself. I don't know, maybe or maybe not. You don't have to answer that either. Does that speak to what you're saying? There's no. I don't have a final answer on it.
It's only that you said that profound morality.
Yes.
And these cultures don't seem to have that profound morality because, I mean, I'm talking about Thailand. I mean, you go to the markets, they're just chopping chicken heads up and chopping up people.
It's functional, yes.
Yeah. Mm. And even the Thai temples around here, you know.
Certainly.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just a bit of meat, it's virtually everything.
It's well, that's right, yes, yeah. And because in the West they can. I know many people from a variety of Asian cultures, and certainly they become enculturated, and what isn't a practice back home becomes, yeah, but is a practice here, that is eating lots of meat, becomes the practice as well. And so we don't see the traditional diet. That's not an argument for the traditional diet.
Well, one thing we should consider is, you know, when the Buddha lived and did the alms round,
yeah,
the population was a lot smaller, maybe 20, 30 million people in India, so... We didn't have these big factory farms.
Correct. And also, has anybody seen a chicken in the wild, just a normal bird? There's not much flesh on that chicken. It's mostly legs and neck. You know, so the things that we call chickens are really, you know, these things that have been bred to be huge and grow very quickly, very fast. Bang, they push them out there. This is not the way of things. That doesn't come to the fundamental issue of eating meat. And that's something for each of us to approach, really. is it acceptable for us to do it for ourselves? The principle underlying all this is non-harm. And the way it's been argued sometimes is, well, I didn't ask that person to kill the chicken for me, therefore I'm not causing any harm. You know, people, Westerners particularly, have problems with that particular argument, a bit of what we call sophistry. So, more questions, really, in that too. We have to come to our own view, which is what I'm trying to say for this whole talk, really, in a way. And we're informed by what we see around us in terms of what other Buddhists do as well, what we read about. Yes, we've got time for one last question here, I think. Yeah.
I was just wondering, so what you were speaking about in terms of the pain that
should, oh, yes.
I should have, I could have.
If only, yeah.
Given that in itself is a concept that many of us who lead relatively very normal, very happy lives struggle with, like, especially in your profession where you're dealing with all these groups of people and, like, people dying around them, like, how do you sort of get them out of that mindset?
I can't get them out of it. They have to get themselves out. But what I can do is point towards what I think is happening. And so this is this investigation practice that I personally would regard as part of Buddhism, whether it's this macro day-to-day level, whether it's the micro meditation level. So it becomes obvious over a period of time that there's this rumination, this story, this way of thinking that's going on and on and on. And to bring that out in the open is the beginning of insight, because we see, oh, I'm doing this. Is it solving anything? No. Is it making things worse? Well, possibly it is. Is it rational? Is it reasonable? Probably not. Is it understandable? Of course it's understandable. If your child dies, I've never met anybody who goes, oh, well, that's the way the world is. Things change. There's, as a parent, one feels strongly one should have saved and nurtured one's child. So, you know, this regret is built in. And for some people, they, of course, it never goes. In fact, for many, most people, perhaps. But what we can do is see whether it's useful, whether it's helpful, and begin to work with that insight in many different ways. So for me, it starts with being very clear about what's going on for ourselves. And then if we can see one step further, this is a cause of suffering that, to some extent, I'm going along with. I mightn't be producing it deliberately. It comes about because of causes and conditions. But if through not seeing it clearly, I'm habituating myself to it, to this suffering, then we've got something we can work with then. That's already the beginning of seeing pain. And with pain, we tend to recoil and go, no, I see that it's painful. And maybe I've got a choice here. We need space around it in order to do something with it. So that broad level contemplation and seeing clearly, even in conversation or reflection, incredibly important. Which is, takes us back to that original story of Siddhartha's motivation for leaving home. So we can work with it for sure. We have to. That's where we start. It's what brings people here, I guess. All right. Okay, one last question. Yeah.
What do you mean about, like, given your profession and the kind of country that you come across, I'm sort of wondering about the application of meditation in helping yourself as well as helping your
life as well. Yeah. Look, I don't go out of my way to offer meditation to people who come to see me. They don't come to see a Buddhist counsellor. They come to see a member of the palliative care team. That said, it's there as a possibility. I prefer to think that there's a way of being with people which can be models of those meditative ways of being, investigation and so forth. You know, really compassionate investigation and patience and support over time, friendliness, generosity and so forth. There's a way of being with people that models hopefully what we've contemplated and maybe what we've practiced at all in terms of a more formal practice or practiced amongst our peer group as well. That might lead to more formal practices. One thing we need to be very careful of with those extreme experiences is somehow suggesting to people that they shouldn't be feeling that way. The truth is they are feeling that way. That's the truth for all of us. We all have our thoughts. We all have certain feelings. That's our starting point. So if I was to offer a meditation practice, I have to be very careful that it's not sounding like if you do this, then you'll be able to stop doing that thing that's wrong. You know, so there's some caution to be advised. So initially it's a way of being with people, I think, that allows for something more to emerge, maybe some space, but it takes some tolerance and patience to do that too. And a willingness to be present without having the answers. So this takes us right back to really what I started with, maybe closing here, that in the talk tonight and in maybe learning more about Buddhism, it's not to have the answers to fire at people, or even to offer them in some sort of hard-edged way. If we can't model them first, then what are we doing? Anybody else can go online and read their stuff for themselves. It's got to come from our own experience, doesn't it? And that's exactly the same as Siddhartha. That's where we are. We have the same human birthright as Siddhartha. And that is to explore more deeply who we are, to take that on board for ourselves, to model it, to practice it, to live it, such that it's available should it be requested. Or the opportunity be right for that as well. Yeah. That's a lovely last question. Thank you for that. Okay, so thank you, everybody. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. I really wish you well for the year in your studies, but also in your peer group support as well.